Hello, I'm Christian Gravener. This is number 0198, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
There, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0198. And coming to you on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet NASA expert Rod Pyle, who talks about Skylab on the 40th anniversary of the space station. Skylab was, and still is, the largest single man-made volume ever occupied in space.
The ISS is bigger in total volume, but in terms of one big area where people could do their work, it was by far the largest. And in fact, the first crew, which is headed by Pete Conrad, who's kind of known as a practical joker and a trickster of the astronauts, used to make a game of getting on one end of it and pushing off and seeing who could get closest to a target they drew on the other end of the containment vessel. So that was kind of a cool thing.
Mark Richardson, author of Canada's Road. He took a journey right across this land on the Trans-Canada Highway, all 8,000 kilometers of it.
Well, it's huge, and it's probably the best maintained highway as well that goes right across the country. It is almost 8,000 kilometers, though you know what? It keeps shrinking. If you go the most direct route, it's actually about 7,600 kilometers now, because they keep straightening bits and improving bits. Originally, when it came out 50 years ago, it would go right through the middle of downtown in some places, but now it'll bypass and go more quickly. So you can use it as a place to just get somewhere fast, or you can use it as a place to pull off and have a look at stuff.
Peter Franklin, the Gabby Cabby, shares a slice of the Big Apple from his yellow mobile conveyance lounge. He has many interesting stories to share, including one about a certain hot dog street vendor.
Well, it's an interesting story about being an entrepreneur because she has a hot dog stand and she was selling people hot dogs, and then she was booking an appointment to give them a little musky-fusky at a nearby motel. Sort of two sales in one. Well, she got arrested the first time, I think it was about 6 or 7 months ago, because I guess it's against the law to be a prostitute and sell wieners.
And we have lots and lots and lots of stuff, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0198, was Christian Gravener, who's a web reporter at CTV News in Montreal. He also has a great Montreal blog called Coolopolis. You should check that one out. And he's currently working on a book about his experiences as a slumlord. Thank you very much, Christian, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Well, a man called police in Daytona Beach, Florida, and asked them to respond to a convenience store. When the officer arrived, Dalen Holloman, age 20, couldn't tell the officer why he had called. The officer asked, "What's going on? Who are you? And where are you from?" And each time, Holloman would reply, "I don't know." The exasperated officer finally said, "What do you know?" And Holloman replied, "I know I'm a monkey." Yeah. The officer replied that he couldn't be, since monkeys don't wear clothing. So Holloman quickly stripped and refused to put his clothes back on. The officer arrested him on a charge of indecent exposure and took him to jail. The officer noted in his report that Holloman seemed to be of sound mind. Really? Okay. Well, at least Holloman didn't throw his feces at the officer. Okay. Moving right along, this is a story that I really like. Gordon Bessaw and his guide dog, Derby, were walking to a bus stop in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. "And that's when the guy approached me," Bessaw said, "and he asked me, 'Are you blind?' And I said, 'Yes.' He said, 'I can make you see before you see God.' The man told Bessaw to take off his glasses, but when Bessaw tried to walk away, the man allegedly started punching him in the face. He said, 'I can make you see again.' And he punched me in the head again, and I was like, 'Man, you're not going to like the way this is going to go.'" Bessaw, you see, is a former U.S. Army Special Forces member, and he defended himself. This is his quote. "I hip-tossed him, letting go of the leash, and when I hit the ground on top of him, I told my dog to stay, and I began to choke him. When police arrived, they found Bessa on top of Christopher Andrew, who was 27, who they arrested for aggravated assault and battery. "I just want the guy to leave me alone and get help," Bessa said. Gee, now who's blind? Hopefully Christopher Andrew will eventually see the light. Yeah. And in Sacramento, California, Sheriff Deputy Matt Compoy stepped out of the county jail at the end of his shift and saw a woman approaching him. "I stepped to the left, and she stepped to my left." Remembering Compoy, "I stepped to the right, and she stepped to my right. I stepped to the left again, and suddenly she stepped into me and slapped my face." Campoy was stunned for a moment, but then grabbed Etta Mae Lopez, age 31, and took her inside the jail, where she slapped his arm as soon as he turned her loose. She was arrested and booked. Campoy said that once he put her into a cell, Lopez confided that she was trying to quit smoking and hoped the slap would lead to time in a smoke-free jail, thus helping her to quit. Well, the tactic worked, because she was convicted of battery on a police officer and sentenced to 63 days in jail. Well, plus she gets free meals. Sure beats paying for the patch, I guess. Ruben Pavon was caught on camera allegedly stealing a grill from the front of a thrift store in Derry, New Hampshire. His son is shown helping him carry it off, but Pavon claims he was just confused by the store's sign and has taken items from there before. "I just grabbed one. I thought it was there for the taking," he said. The sign did say Finders Keepers, so I took the DVD player, took it home. A couple of weeks later, the stuff is still there on the porch, so I'm thinking to myself, Finders Keepers. They probably just put stuff out there for people to take. Yeah, the thrift store is indeed called Finders Keepers. It donates proceeds from sales to charities for children and U.S. troops. "I don't know of any stores where there's free stuff," said the store owner, Laura Barker. Pavon has returned the items, but the police are still investigating. "I just want to clear my name and say that I'm not a bad dad," he said. "I'm the best dad in the world." Yeah, of course he is. He probably read that on the mug his kid got from the same store. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, an unnamed 14-year-old boy in Prospect Heights, Illinois, met a woman online and decided she was a prostitute. He therefore arranged to hire her for sex, and she came over to his house. She told him to go into a bedroom to undress, but she didn't provide sex. Instead, police say she pepper sprayed him in the face, stole his piggy bank and iPad, and fled. When she later turned on the iPad, it checked in and gave investigators her location. Derica R. Brooks, age 22, was arrested and charged with armed robbery. Well, let's hope the lesson he actually learned here serves him more than the one that he had planned on. Yeah. Anyway, on to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Hard to believe that this is the 40th anniversary of Skylab, America's first space station. It was and is the largest single volume ever occupied in space. And joining us to talk about it right now is NASA expert Rod Pyle. Rod has written several books. His latest is entitled Destination Mars. He has also produced numerous documentaries on the History Channel and Discovery Communications, and he's an adjunct professor at the University of Laverne and a lecturer with the NASA Johnson Space Center. Rod joins us on the line right now via Skype to Skype communications from Pasadena, California. Hi, Rod.
Hi, how you doing tonight?
Just tickety-boo. So 40 years, I feel old, 40 years that Skylab first went up into space. Looking back at it now, how revolutionary is that with all that's taken place since?
It was a big deal. You know, this was started in the 1960s as a way to try and find utilization of the Apollo hardware after the moon program was done. And they canceled the last three Apollo flights, which would have been 18, 19, and 20 for a variety of reasons, some budgetary, some safety concerns, and thought, well, you know, let's use one of those Saturn rockets we've got sitting around for this space station project. So, you know, ideas have been kicked around for years. Wernher von Braun had his idea of a big wheel in space that would have taken, I think, 60 launches to build and so forth. So what they finally did was they took the upper stage of the Saturn V that normally was used to send the moon rocket out to land on the moon, and they took that stage and emptied it out and filled it full of hardware and made that the space station. But it was about 23 feet by 80, so it was a great big empty space that they were able to fill up with enough hardware that people could stay up there for about 3 months at a time. So three crews did that. It was a spectacular achievement, but upon launch, they had some serious problems they had to clean up.
Now, as I said in the introduction, it was the largest single volume ever occupied in space, and apparently still is?
Yeah. The ISS is bigger in total volume, but in terms of one big area where people could do their work, it was by far the largest. And in fact, the first crew, which is headed by Pete Conrad, who's kind of known as a practical joker and a trickster of the astronauts, used to make a game of getting on one end of it and pushing off and seeing who could get closest to a target they painted, they drew on the other end of the containment vessel. So that was kind of a cool thing.
So what you're saying is the difference between Skylab and the current space station is that the current space station is more modular.
Right. It's broken up into smaller areas. It's broken up into different modules and habitats and, you know, a couple pieces built by the Russians, a bunch built by us, one built by Japan, and then they're all connected on different nodes. So it was a great design in that you could fly pieces up with the shuttle, which, of course, was the only thing capable at that time of taking up pieces of the new space station and connect them together. Skylab is just a single piece that was put up by the Saturn, which was had a lot more lifting power than the shuttle did.
It was only up there from 1973 to 79. During that period of time, did it live up to all its expectations, or were there some things and some ways that it fell short?
No, actually, it lived up to everything they wanted. Like I said, they had some problems upon launch. A solar panel got torn off, and some other stuff got compromised. So it took them a while to get all that straightened out. But after some cowboy tactics and a lot of clever, innovative thinking, they managed to get it cobbled together enough that it was able to fulfill almost every objective they had. And as I said, it hosted three crews with durations up to about 3 months. So they were able to do a lot of solar astronomy. They were able to do a lot of microgravity research. They were able to, for the first time really, look at long-duration effects on the human body of weightlessness. And those are really the three things they wanted to do, and they achieved them with a lot of results to spare.
What was its most important achievement, would you say, of those three?
Probably the microgravity effects on the body, because really at that point we still didn't know. I mean, the space age was still fairly young. We had only been going into space at that point for about 11 or 12 years. So there wasn't a lot of knowledge. The longest flights up till that point had been the Gemini flights, where those guys sat in that little thing the size of a small garbage dumpster for 2 weeks. Pretty grim. So this gave them a chance to be in comfort and move around for a period of months and actually exercise so they could try and keep their bone density up and their bodies in some kind of condition so when they came back they wouldn't be a weak and wrung out as the body will do when it's in microgravity.
I grew up in the 60s during the height of the space race, so I saw all of the, from Mercury to Apollo and beyond. Looking at the situation now, when you see Americans, and by extension Canadians, going up in a tin can on the Soyuz rocket and coming back that way nowadays, have we fallen short of the goals we anticipated we would be seeing at this point? I mean, your title of your book is Destination Mars.
Well, you know, when I was a kid, Mars was 30 years away, they kept saying, and they're saying now it's about 20 years away at best. So, yeah, I think we've fallen short of what a lot of us hoped for. There's a lot of reasons for that. Some of them are political, some of them are financial. Some of them make more sense than others, but there's a lot of things we could be doing up there that we're not. The idea that we're riding with the Russians rankles a lot of people, but the shuttle was really expensive to operate. It was a dangerous spacecraft. It was a brilliant design for its time, but that design was baselined in 1972, and it was a compromise at best. It was never funded to its full extent, and they had to make a lot of shortcut decisions to make it work. So, and you know, you've got the Soyuz, which was designed in the early 60s as the Russians' attempt to get to the moon. They've been building that same spacecraft since then, hundreds and hundreds of times. So it's fairly safe. It's very reliable. It's getting a little creaky, but it does its job. So it's $70 million a seat. It's kind of a bargain compared to the shuttle, which if you amortize it over the program is about $1.5 billion a flight. So it works. But I think we're all hoping to see – I went to a couple of conferences last week, and private space was a big – you know, commercial space was a big factor. And a lot of us are very, very excited about Elon Musk's Dragon capsule and how soon that might be man-rated. And once that happens, or the Boeing 100 capsule, once either of those are ready to go, now you've got routine, reliable American access to space back, and a lot cheaper than $70 million a seat.
Okay, well, let me ask you this hypothetical situation. You mentioned the economy is part of the situation as to why Americans haven't gone into space the way they used to back in the day. But there was also the Cold War.
Mm-hmm.
Would there have been, in your estimation, as much of a space race if there wasn't the Cold War and the potential or the fear of someone militarizing space before the other?
No, I think that's a really intelligent statement. We would have done very little and much more slowly. I think even von Braun figured the moon was achievable by the mid to late 70s until suddenly the checkbook opened up. No amount was too much. Kennedy said, we're going, and I want it done by 1970. And that really threw the fire under those guys. Even James Webb, who was in charge of NASA at that point, was scratching his head saying, oh, my God, we don't even know what we don't know yet. We don't have the metals. We don't have the system science. We don't have the computers. The lunar module and command module flew to the moon, landed, and came back on computers that could have done most of that job by themselves that were 36K, and they had 2K of RAM. So you can bet that Microsoft didn't write that software.
Nowadays, our phones have more technology than what took man to the moon.
Honestly, your toaster probably does. I'm not kidding. I mean, your phone is such a revolutionary device. What did I read the other day? The average smartphone has more computing power than the world did 15 years ago or something like that. I mean, it's incredible. So when you really look at – I just wrote a chapter for a book on innovation I'm doing about the Apollo computers – 36K isn't very much. That's a tenth of one of those old plastic floppy drives. So it was a tiny amount. The memory was done with magnetic cores and had wires hand-threaded through them. They hired ladies in the Midwest that were former seamstresses because they were the only people that could actually do work that fine. And if 2 weeks before you were going to fly, you had to change a command in the root software, you had to take that board out and send it back, and they had to reroute the wires. So it was pretty primitive technology, but the amazing thing is that it worked. Another author I know said very wisely once, I think, it's as if John F. Kennedy reached in the 21st century and pulled Apollo back to the 60s. And it still blows my mind. I see sometimes the films of the stuff those guys did on the lunar surface and getting there and coming back and think, I can barely believe we did it, and yet that's 40-plus years ago.
Do you think the other side of that coin, we would have all the technology we have today if we didn't have that space race?
Not at all. I mean, so much derives from that. It was the first use of integrated circuits in that computer. The material science that went into designing the rocket and the capsule, and especially the lunar module, because that thing was as thin as a Coke can in some places. You know, the computational abilities and the mathematics to get out there and back. I mean, there's so many areas, medical, in which that program really pushed the envelope. And that's, you know, you talk about today's space program and should we go and why are we spending money and all that. And I mean, you know this as well as I do, but just for the sake of the audience, there's a lot of people out there that still feel like they've got this image in their head, I think, of we're shoveling gold doubloons into space capsules and blowing it out in space and it's gone forever. It's not it. We build these things here. They're built by American companies with American labor. It's one of the few things we do better than anybody in the world, except for maybe weapons and software and entertainment, of course. So I think from that standpoint, the space program is very good for the country. It's a net win all the way around. It pushes technology. It encourages kids to go into these fields. NASA's, for a long time, up till the sequester, been one of the largest financial supporters of education in the country from the government side. So there's a whole lot of good reasons to do that. I think the question now is where? You know, there's a lot of talk about Mars again. There's a lot of talk now about going out to an asteroid. Do we go to the asteroid or do we bring it nearer to Earth and go out and rendezvous with it that way? It's hard to get the public excited about asteroids, and I understand that. Mars is kind of the holy grail.
Well, it's been 40 years since Skylab. Hopefully it won't be another 40 years before something really exciting takes place again. As you say, there is that story of Destination Mars, which, as I said, is the title of your book. So there you go.
Thanks for the pitch.
Rod, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to talk with us. It's most fascinating indeed.
I'd love to do it again.
Rod Pyle, author of Destination Mars, talking about, among other things, Skylab. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0198, and you'll find links to Rod's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's The Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of The Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick. If you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
You're experiencing The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Sit back, relax, let it rattle around between your ears, tickling your cerebellum, and enjoy.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about Canada's road. That would be the Trans-Canada Highway. Plus, Peter Franklin, the Gabby Cabby, shares a slice of the Big Apple from his Yellow Mobile Conveyance Lounge. And we have a lot more Stuff File news right here on a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Let's get right back to the stuff. Abdullah Riaz, age 50, was arrested at the Rajiv Gandhi International Airport in Hyderabad, India, in April, after he appeared to be uncomfortable sitting in the waiting room. Officials found four biscuits, that's what they're calling them, biscuits of solid gold in his socks, but obviously thought there might be more. And after nature took its course, yeah, they found Abdullah to be one of those rare humans with the ability to brag that he once excreted gold, because eight more biscuits were coming out, to be exact. Well, there's nothing I can really add to that story, so let's just move along. While playing with a pistol, Pete J. Rodriguez, age 24, allegedly shot a 14-year-old boy in the leg in their home in Houston, Texas. Home surveillance video shows that the boy laid there for several minutes, then got up. The boy's mother then took immediate action. She allegedly got online with her son and looked up gunshot treatments on the WebMD website. 7 hours later, the mother finally drove her son to the hospital. Rodriguez was charged with one count of injury to a child with the intent to commit serious bodily injury, while the mother is being investigated for injury to a child by omission. Gee, I wonder if WebMD has a treatment for parental oblivacy. And a Medford, Massachusetts man was arrested at Forest Hills MBTA station after he attempted to open up a hot dog stand that did not belong to him. It was about 5 a.m. when an MBTA employee at the station noticed that Dana Reese, age 56, was opening the stand, and He called police. The worker was familiar with the man who usually runs the stand and knew it didn't typically open until later in the morning. Dana allegedly told police that he was filling in for his friend, but he didn't have any contact information for the stand operator or a vending license. A record check found Dana was wanted on warrants stemming from multiple drug violations in Boston and charges of larceny and defrauding an innkeeper in the Worcester District Court. Now, he was arrested on outstanding charges. Well, let's look at this on the bright side. He's a crook, but at least he's willing to work. Two longtime friends ended up in jail in Central Florida thanks to a bucket list that included stealing from a store. Police say 36-year-old Andrea Mobley and 38-year-old Jennifer Morrow face petty theft charges after stealing bathing suits and beef jerky during a trip to Walmart. Because, as you know, if you listen to the show long enough, everything happens at Walmart. A loss prevention officer told police Mobley was actually eating the beef jerky in the store. Now, how sad is your bucket list if it includes stealing bathing suits and beef jerky? Aim high. That's what I'm saying. Moving right along, the New York Office of Mental Health is selling on eBay a used morgue refrigerator from a Manhattan psychiatric ward. About a day after the item was first posted on the auction site, the price was at $1,050. The eBay listing describes the refrigerator as used with signs of cosmetic wear, but fully operational. Heather Grawl, who is a spokeswoman for the Office of General Services, says she's never seen a government agency sell a morgue cooler. That's an understatement. Every once in a while, we get an unusual item, and this would be that, she said. Whoever buys it would have to come and pick it up, so he or she would have to have some familiarity with refrigerators like that. She said the cooler would have to be dismantled to be removed from the room where it is currently housed in the Manhattan Psychiatric Center. The auction ends in late June. Okay, now, wouldn't you be really, really concerned about the person who is actually buying this? Or have I just been watching too many episodes of Criminal Minds? And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, a man in Russia looking for a date thought shock tactics would trump sending a sweet card. And for going the unorthodox route of catching the girl's eye, he faces the prospect of 5 years behind bars. Police say they arrested the man after he took a 16-year-old girl hostage and demanded a date with his older sister. According to a statement from the local interior ministry, the suspect busted into the girl's home early Saturday looking for her sister. Police say that when he did not find her, he took out a weapon that resembled an assault rifle and placed what looked like an explosive device on a door. The man demanded that the teenager call his sister or he would blow up the house. Police managed to convince the man to surrender and arrested him. They said they confiscated an air gun and a bundle of green wire that resembled a grenade. Well, ladies, you'll be glad to know that he's out of the dating pool for a while. Let's get to our next guest, shall we? Mark Richardson is the author of Canada's Road, a journey on the Trans-Canada Highway from St. John's to Vancouver. He actually drove the entire length of the 8,000-kilometer highway in the summer of 2012, which, incidentally, was the highway's 50th birthday. He joins us on the line right now from Cobourg, Ontario, to talk about the book and his trip. Hi, Mark.
Hi, how you doing?
Just tickety-boo. I noticed right on the back, right on the back of your book, it mentions that Russia has the Trans-Siberian Highway and Australia has Highway 1. Of course, those are two countries that have a large landmass. As far as highways are concerned, where does the Trans-Canada Highway rank in terms of its size compared to other countries?
Well, it's huge, and it's probably the best-maintained highway as well. It goes right across the country. It is almost 8,000 kilometers, though you know what? It keeps shrinking. If you go the most direct route, as I did mostly, it's actually about 7,600 kilometers now, because they keep straightening bits and improving bits. And also, you know, it used to, originally, when it came out 50 years ago, it would go right through the middle of downtown in some places. But now it'll bypass and go more quickly. So you can use it as a place to just get somewhere fast, or you can use it as a place to pull off and have a look at stuff. And there is, the thing about Canada is, you know, it's so varied, right? You've got mountains and prairie and French and English and Atlantic Canada and all of that stuff. And the Trans-Canada crosses it all. It's quite something.
Now, you mentioned that you can get quickly from point A to point B. I've had the opportunity in the past to talk to people who have traveled similar highways in the United States, for instance. And one of the things that they always lament, especially places like Route 66 and whatnot, is that when these big highways were built, it kind of cut off a lot of places that people would stop along the way to meander and check things out across the United States. Has it been a similar situation in Canada?
A little bit in some places, that's true. And I mean, this is the whole premise of that movie that came out, Cars, right? The terrific movie from before, that it has whole communities that have been isolated off the highway that nobody stops at anymore. And that's true with the U.S. interstate system. And you can just blow right through the states in no time at all if you want to on those suckers. But on the Trans-Canada, the Trans-Canada splits in places. It'll actually be two different roads in areas. You know, you can go around the city like in Calgary. You can bypass Calgary, or you can go right through the middle of Calgary. People probably don't even realize they're on the Trans-Canada. In Winnipeg, it goes right through, almost to Portage and Maine. That's the Trans-Canada. It'll take you right through if you want to. Plus, it's also not all limited access highway, you know, where you have ramps and things coming on. So you'll have people with driveways. I stayed in a farm in Saskatchewan. The driveway of the farm goes right onto the Trans-Canada Highway. It doesn't bypass a thing. And in fact, they took me out to go and see the original highway from 100 years or so ago, which was just ruts in the ground a couple of miles north. The Trans-Canada Highway has pretty much followed the original highways, even the native trails from many hundreds of years ago. It's quite the historic thing. But there are other areas, like in New Brunswick, for example, and in Quebec, where it is a three-lane highway that just blows right through and gets you where you want to go very, very quickly. In those cases, I did both. I drove the highway itself, and I also drove off the highway to go and look at the older stretches of road, the older places.
Now, you're an automotive writer. You do a lot of reviews. You've written this book. You do a lot of driving. You do a lot of writing about driving. So when you do this trip, someone for you who this is almost second nature now, still, I'm sure on the 8,000 kilometers, somewhere along the way, you must have had a couple of aha moments, even for you.
I did. Yeah, I did. And in fact, I do talk about them a little bit in my book. But the real big aha moment for me came at the very, very, very end, when I literally had finished and got to Victoria. And somebody had asked me, so a newspaper reporter in Regina, Saskatchewan, said, well, what's your aha moment been so far, Mark? And, I mean, I'd met some interesting people, fascinating people, really. I'd seen some interesting stuff. I'd learned a lot of things I never knew. But I hadn't had that sort of jumping out at you moment. But right at the very end, I was reading. See, 100 years ago, there were two guys who crossed the country because I wrote this book partly about the Trans-Canada Highway that was 50 years old last summer, and partly about the original road trip, the very first one done by two guys in 1912, 100 years previously. They went from Halifax to Victoria. But they had to duck into the States. They had to put the car on railway tracks and on boats and things, you know, where there were no roads. And the thing is that right at the very end of their trip, this guy gets out and he's staying in the hotel in Victoria, and he goes and looks at this monument that's put up by a guy who had long hoped that there would be a road across Canada. And he writes in his book 100 years ago that he had done this. And so I thought, well, I should go and have a look at this monument, see if it's still there. And I asked the guy at the hotel, because I was staying right next to the Legislative Assembly in Victoria, I asked the guy at the hotel where the monument was, and he said, oh, I don't know. I don't know if it's there anymore. Might be able to ask around. I went outside, and I sort of walked onto the grounds, and there it was, right in front of me, not hiding at all. It was a monument put up a long time ago by this guy who had wanted a road. And the thing is that nobody even knew it was there. It was completely forgotten about. And that was, to me, exactly the same as the Trans-Canada Highway. You don't usually go around thinking about the Trans-Canada Highway, what a great link it is across the country, the fact that it connects all the different types of people and all the different areas of Canada. You just know that it's there. You know what? Most people couldn't believe it was the 50th anniversary. They assumed it was at least 100 years old because it's always been there. We take it completely for granted. And yet it was such a huge battle even to get the thing built. It wasn't even finished properly until 1970 or so.
Well,
that was my aha moment when I realized just how much everybody takes this road for granted.
That was actually my next question, the fact that we do take it for granted. Is that one of the reasons you actually wrote the book to get us to realize, hey, there's a very important road that connects us all, and it's there?
Well, yes, that's right. I mean, I realized the year before, 2011, I realized that the Trans-Canada was going to have an anniversary on the 50th anniversary. And I thought that was kind of interesting. Because I was also going to turn 50 years old the same year. And I thought, oh, well, I share a birthday with that. That's neat. So I sort of looked into it a little bit. I mean, just Googling it, right? Just out of curiosity to try and find out when it got opened, that sort of thing. There was very little information in there about the highway. Not a lot to be said. So I figured, well, then I found out that, in fact, I shared a birthday literally with the highway. That the thing was opened on July the 30th, 1962, which was the same day that I was born. And people said, Mark, you know, you're born to drive this highway. You should do it. And, you know, I always like a good road trip, so it seemed like a good excuse. So I set off last year. It was great fun.
You mentioned that it's one of the best maintained highways in the world. You know, now,
I don't know about that, actually. I mean, sections of it are, but there are other parts that are pretty bad. I mean, across Manitoba, for example, I got a stone chip through the window from constant construction, and it's the CAA figures that it's on the top 10 worst roads in the province. I mean, it depends how you want to think of it. If you want to think of it just as a strip of asphalt to get you from A to B, then the interstate system is better, and that costs 100 times as much as the Trans-Canada Highway. But as a road that takes you somewhere that you want to be and sort of shows you some of the country and stuff, then it's unsurpassed.
Is there any part of the densely populated area, because obviously it goes from coast to coast, it doesn't go north-south, is there a part of the country that is not serviced by...
Yeah, absolutely. All of southern Ontario is not serviced. The Trans-Canada Highway, when it was originally mapped out and decided, I mean, they first thought about seriously building it, and it's all about political bickering, right, as to who's going to pay for what. That was in 1949 or so, and the idea was that it was going to be a road that would get you from coast to coast in about as short a distance as possible. It wasn't going to vary all around the country in order to take in too much. So it doesn't go to Toronto. It goes from Ottawa up to over to Sault Ste. Marie and north of the lake. But it cuts around both sides of Algonquin Park, for example. But it doesn't go into southern Ontario. Highway 7 is officially the Trans-Canada. It goes to about Peterborough and then knocks north up to Barrie. So it gives you access to southern Ontario, but it doesn't take you down there. It doesn't go. People assume the 401 is it, but it's nothing to do with the Trans-Canada at all. Also in New Brunswick, St. John is not serviced. Halifax is not serviced by the Trans-Canada Highway in Nova Scotia. It bypasses that completely because that would be out of the way of connecting the one end to the other.
I got to ask one last question. What car did you drive in?
I drove in the only car I possibly could have done. I thought about what car did I want, And I'm lucky. I mean, I write about cars. I know people in the industry, so I could ask for a car, and people would actually listen to me and consider it. And in this case, I wanted a car that was had a little bit of history that could go back to the 60s, you know, the time of the Trans-Canada. I wanted a car that was Canadian-built, and I wanted a car also that was convertible so I could make the most of the mountains and the prairie and stuff. And it'd be kind of cool if the car was yellow. So I called up the guy from General Motors, and I said, hey, have you got a new Chevy Camaro convertible that I can put about 30,000 kilometers on this summer? And he gulped a bit, but he said, sure. Do you want the automatic or the stick shift? And so I took a stick shift V6 Camaro convertible across the country, and it was fabulous. Never put a foot wrong.
Nice.
It was nice, yeah.
And you gave it back to them, as you say, with some stone chips.
I'm afraid I did. I gave it back. It had some bugs on it by the time I gave it back. But yeah. But it ran as well as the day I picked it up. I was impressed.
The book is called Canada's Road, A Journey on the Trans-Canada Highway from St. John's to Vancouver, published by Dundurn Press, written by Mark Richardson. Mark, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program.
It's been my great pleasure. Thanks.
Mark Richardson, author of Canada's Road, a journey on the Trans-Canada Highway from St. John's to Vancouver. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0198, and you'll find links to Mark's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRico-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Reputation, as they say, is everything. That's why, several years ago, the president of what today is the largest law school in America decided to do a poll about law school reputations. His school ranked below where he believed it should be in most surveys, so he created a list of 10 law schools and asked 100 lawyers to rank them. The list included Harvard, Yale, Penn State, and 7 others. When the results came back, Penn State was ranked right in the middle. The only problem is that Penn State doesn't have a law school. The point that the law school president was trying to make was that sometimes we lean too much on reputation when making decisions. Let's be fair, I believe the same principle applies to courts. Courts have a reputation among many lawyers as the only place to properly resolve conflicts. However, other solutions like mediation and arbitration can often bring victims better results, legally, at a lower cost. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
From our studios in Montreal, Canada, and going out to the rest of the world, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Now, the Stuff File presents the Gabby Cabby, direct from his yellow mobile conveyance lounge in the city that never sleeps, New York. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And from the mean streets of New York, we do indeed have Peter Franklin once again. Hello, sir.
Hello, hello, hello.
Nice to have you back on the program again. Now that the summer is here, or just about here, I understand that it's an opportunity for people to watch movies outdoors again, on rooftops, no less.
Yeah, well, the whole tone and, the texture, the rhythm of New York City changes as soon as summer comes in really a very big way. And so you have things like rooftop movies, movies in the parks, concerts in the parks, you know, all kinds of festivals, street fairs, parades, all those things that during the colder months would have cost you a fortune, you get basically for nothing in New York City. It changes really everybody's attitude. Everybody's out on the streets more than before. Everybody gets to see what everybody else looks like because they're no longer wearing hats and hoods and all of that. So there's a picture on my website, Gabby.com, which shows the typical rooftop movie. It's really kind of neat and kind of fun.
Now, who does these rooftop movies?
Well, in almost all instances, it's done either by the City of New York or organizations and associations. Frankly, I don't know of anyone that's for profit, but there might be one or two, you know, floating around. But even at that, if you did have to pay and some guy makes some money on it, I don't know that's terrible either.
So it's basically just a big screen that somebody puts up on a roof, and people, I guess, bring their lawn chairs, and they sit on the roof and watch a film.
Exactly, and they also do it on a barge. There's some barges that go around on the rivers, and they pull them up to the shoreline, and, you know, at a place where there might be seating, and people will sit on the shoreline watching the movie that's, on the barge. We also, during the summertime, have barges that are actually freshwater swimming pools, and they get towed to different parts of the city where people for that day can swim in a pool that's kind of close to them. The city of New York gets a very strong asterisk in terms of trying to do everything for everybody under most circumstances.
Sounds like fun. Now, besides that, since we're talking about doing things for the summertime, one of the things people like to do is they like to obviously try and keep cool, either get in air-conditioned places or certainly have some frozen treats. And frozen treats, I understand, are also now available for man's best friend.
Yeah, it's an interesting idea. I mean, you know, who amongst us who has a dog has never given the dog some ice cream? But what these people are doing is they're actually setting up trucks, sort of like the Mr. Softy trucks that go around, ding-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling, you know, and the kids come running over to buy their ice cream. Well, in this case, it's going to be specifically for dogs. Now, I'm not so sure that the ice cream is that much different or the frozen yogurt is that much different than human consumption. So the gimmick really is the decoration and design on the truck itself, and, of course, the shape of the bowls you know, in which the ice cream or the yogurt's going to be in so that the pet can have some. But, you know, it's very hard for the average dog to eat an ice cream cone. Mm.
Would you say you don't think it's that much different from the ice cream that humans have? Would you taste it? Would you try it?
I would. I think you could do, frankly, in New York City, you could do that with dog food also, because the people who manufacture this stuff aren't going to take a chance. They know someplace, somewhere, that somebody is going to try dog food, try cat food, you may not like the taste of it, but in my own mind, it's inconceivable that they aren't careful about the health standards. Frankly, I've never heard of anybody ever getting sick from eating pet food in any way, so I don't know. It's a kind of sounds icky poo thing to do, but if you want to bet me $10, I won't. I'll take you $10.
Okay. Now, you can get all kinds of food on the street. People know, for instance, the hot dog vendors are out there on New York everywhere, but I understand there was one woman who was selling more than just hot dogs.
How did I know you were going to ask me about that story, you filthy little man? Well, it's an interesting story about being an entrepreneur, because she has a hot dog stand, and she was selling people hot dogs, and then she was booking an appointment to give them a little musky-fusky at a nearby motel, sort of two sales in one. Well, she got arrested the first time, I think it was about 6 or 7 months ago, because I guess it's against the law to be a prostitute and sell wieners. But in any event, she's now done it again. She's going back to the slammer, but I guess she's probably making so much money she can afford to pay the fines.
No one has made any complaints or anything about hygiene, you know, proximity to food, all that kind of stuff?
Well, no, but because she's keeping, the two endeavors are kind of, you know, when we first heard the story, we thought she was doing it in the back of the truck. But no, that's not what she's doing. She goes to a nearby motel and takes care of the second event.
Oh, okay. Was there any kind of discount on the food if you purchased the other event?
Having not frequented her establishment, I don't really know.
Okay. Meanwhile, let's talk about another kind of criminal. I understand there was a guy going around who was sticking people up, but he wasn't really asking for much.
This is a classic case of how evil the media is, because when the story first broke, it was that this guy was robbing people on the streets with a knife, and he was saying, "Give me a dollar." And even if they were frightened and wanted to give him more than a dollar, he said, no, just a dollar's enough. And that was really an interesting story, and it was carried in the New York Times, the New York Post, Newsday, Daily News. And as I read it, I thought to myself, there's something just not right about this. I just didn't understand it. And I thought, I bet it's a kid that's doing it. And yet, for purposes of glamorization, the newspapers haven't mentioned that little factor. Well, sure enough, a couple of days ago, they arrested the kid, a 14-year-old kid who was doing it. So I think a more interesting aspect of the story is not so much, that the kid was doing it. He obviously had some serious problems. But why the media went out of its way not to tell people what his age was? Because that's a very critical difference between a 14-year-old robbing other kids and a grown-up robbing adults and only taking a dollar.
Not that I want to defend them in any way, shape, or form. Is it possible that, at least initially, they did not know?
The New York Times, the Daily News, Newsday, Reuters, Associated Press, their staff members, which number in the thousands, their staff is almost as large as mine. I have the world's largest newsroom staff. At any given moment, I have 50,000 taxi drivers reporting to me.
Now, on to other things. The seriousness of what happened in Boston has brought out the point that people are now a little skittish when it comes to backpacks. You have a backpack story.
I have a backpack story.
About somebody...
ladies and gentlemen, this is another senior moment which proves that Peter and I do not rehearse these broadcasts.
Some guy picked up a backpack and...
Oh, okay. Don't be so subtle with your segues, old master of segues. Okay, here's the deal. What the city of New York has been doing, it's just absolutely crazy, wasting, I think, a lot of people's time, is they're planting knapsacks with some, like, a couple of dollars sticking out of the corner, or planting a wallet with a couple of dollars sticking out of the corner, and then they hide, And then if somebody comes along and takes the item and just walks away with it, not trying to turn it into the police department or the nearest police officer, they arrest the person on the thing that, you know, you're supposed to, which I agree with. It's not yours. You give it back. But, you know, the fact of the matter to set up this whole contrived thing to catch people, I think is a little creepy. But that's what they're doing.
It's almost like entrapment.
It is entrapment, but I guess, you know, who says that law and order should be fair, you know? The problem is that in this day and age, I think many people, with the exclusion, of course, of the police in your neighborhood, who I want to stay friendly with, you'd be kind of leery about turning it into the cops because they would keep it. So, you know, we've got a lot of troubles in both my society and to a lesser extent in yours.
Now, I understand that there are some really, really, really cheap cigarettes out there in the New York area.
Yes. Well, you know, New York State has probably the highest highest sales tax and excise tax and all these other taxes on cigarettes. I haven't smoked in years and years and years, but I think it's something like $14 a $15 a pack, I'm not even sure. I mean, I've even heard that there are certain people from Canada, I mean, who shall remain nameless, who kind of bring cigarettes into New York State. But be that as it may, everybody always thought it was just sort of like a mom-pop business, you know, a cottage industry. You smuggle up the cigarettes from maybe Canada, or you smuggle them from North Carolina or South Carolina, and so there's a family with a pickup truck and they're making some money. Well, they just rounded up a bunch of guys who all turned out that of all people they work for, they work for Hamas, the terrorist organization. And what they've been doing is they've been doing all this nefarious smuggling, not to fill their own pockets, but to ship the money over to the Middle East, where it's used for all kinds of other things. So I guess the FBI stopped eating their donuts and stopped drinking their coffee and finally got wind of it.
Wow, okay. Before we let you go, you always see celebrities. So who was the celebrity sighting for this week?
I happen to be in the area of New York University, which is down there, Washington Square Park in Greenwich Village. And by the way, that university is always voted the number one desired university by American high school kids. Because it's in New York, it's Greenwich Village, it's really, you know, artsy, crafty, and it's a good school. Anyway, I was in Washington Square Park, having nothing to do with NYU or the graduation, and who should come walking by but Bono. And Bono had a young girl with him, well, I mean, a college-age kid with him, and a couple of other people, and he was walking along happy and smiling and chatting and everything, and I guessed right, because I subsequently found out later in the newspapers that he had gone to his own daughter's graduation at NYU, and I was trying to think of something very clever to say to him, like he, you know, might have said something to me, and then I would have said, you too? But, you know, he walked by, and that was the end of it.
Always a pleasure, Peter. People can find out more information by going to your website, which is Gabby.com. They could also send you an email to Peter@Gabby.com. Thanks once again for being on the program.
Well, thank you. Bye-bye.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about out of racetrack for this edition of the Stuff File program. We have time for one more item, and you know what that is, boys and girls. Yes, it's time for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
A fugitive wanted by Pennsylvania police was pulled over for traveling in the high-occupancy travel lane without a passenger, and he was caught with more than 400 decks of heroin. 45-year-old Dennis Golston was pulled over for driving alone in the carpool lane. When the troopers approached Golston's car, they smelled marijuana coming from inside. A search of records showed that he was a fugitive wanted by the Pennsylvania State Police, and that he also had outstanding traffic warrants in Newark and Phillipsburg. A search of the car turned up the 410 decks of heroin with an estimated street value of about $4,000. Golston was charged with possession of heroin with the intent to distribute, possession of marijuana, and possession of drug paraphernalia. Now why would someone who is wanted by just about everybody drive by himself in the carpool lane during rush hour, especially when he's carrying $4,000 worth of heroin? One reason, and one reason only. He's an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0198. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number. That's, again, 0198. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com, and remember, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder, and don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Today's broadcast could be heard directly in your home, car, or wireless device, or on your computer, so you can listen on an outpatient basis. For those of you hearing this show directly inside your head, please adjust your medication.